Welcome back to Biff, a podcast about superhero TV shows, movies, games, comics, books, action figures, stone action tablets, cave drawings, and more. My name is Dan Morin, and I am joined by my fellow Kryptonian council heads. John Moltz is here. Hello, John.
I've never been a floating head that I know of.
That's probably good. Guy English is also here. Hello, Guy.
I'm here to fight for truth, justice, and the American way.
I really wanted someone's intro to be guilty.
Yeah, no, you're setting it up, and I couldn't remember a single word any of they said.
That's literally the only word they
said. That was it. That was all they said.
Oh, wait. No, that is not true in the version I watched, which is what I was about to get to.
Oh, no. All right. Yeah. Well, before we...
Well, not oh, no. Believe me, I've seen... Whatever.
All right. Before we get...
It will not be a problem.
Let us set the stage here. So usually, this is our show where we recap a superhero TV show that's on currently, but... A lot of the shows that we watch are currently on hiatus, so we are filling in with a variety of different topics. And this week, we are discussing the 1978 film Superman, sometimes called Superman the Movie, which I think we kind of agreed, as this came up last week, that it was sort of one of the seminal superhero films, right? Like, this was sort of the there were other films before this, let's not, you know, we don't want to sell anything short, but this was certainly in the era of the blockbuster film. This was the first real one.
I kind of feel like it's the most pure superhero movie.
Yes, me too. Well, I was about to say this is the granddaddy of superhero movies.
I have some things that seem weird, but
sure.
Oh yeah, but
there's
sure.
some choices. There's some choices in here.
But wait, so what superhero movie was before this? Was the Batman 66 movie? I guess it was. Batman 66 would have been before this.
Well, but that movie...
But it was basically the TV show. I mean, that was, you know...
Yeah. It was like a
long episode of the TV show.
Wasn't that just a TV... Was it a TV movie, or was it actually theatrical movie?
I don't know.
I think it was theatrical, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, did they do TV movies back then?
I guess not. Like... Oh, yeah. So, yeah, this film hit theaters 2 months after the last episode of the first season of the television series.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just long enough to them to actually record it. Like, they just went back to work the next week.
Exactly, and turned it into a... Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you could count that. There are... And aren't some of the... weren't there, like, Superman serials back in, like, the... 40s?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, there again, depends what you count it, but certainly in the blockbuster era of, like, big budget, you know, giant spectacle movies that we really start getting in, like, the 70s.
I count serials more as TV shows, basically because
pre-TV.
They were a way for people who didn't own TVs to watch TV shows.
Right. Yeah.
You'd go to the movie theater kids would go to the movie theater every week.
Yeah.
Right. Which I still think would be a cool thing to do, but
well,
I mean, obviously not at these prices. That's exorbitant.
No, right,
but
exactly.
But I like the notion. I like the communal notion of it. I do. I really do. Whatever. I guess it's what a cooler TV, but actually, you know, going to the theater seems like a fun thing to do on a regular basis. You know, you take your main squeeze. You get a mint julep.
A mint seems like right up, julep.
Which sounds like right, are you going to?
I don't know. It sounds like right up my alley.
And they're serving mint juleps. Are you sure you haven't gone to the Kentucky
Derby?
You wear
a straw hat.
I don't. I mean, honestly, when I go to the movies now, I order like three beers because the movies are 3 hours long. And
how do you not go to the bathroom?
I don't. I have two, but I always want three because I have to nurse the last one. But anyway.
Yeah, understood.
It's rough. But so this is the, first of all, importantly, I'm looking at now, December 15th, 1978. So it is, this is before the summer blockbuster era, which I believe began with Jaws.
Well,
was Star Wars
but
released
it's post,
in summer?
No, Star Wars released in May.
Okay.
So this is after both. So I was thinking about this in the context of movies around the same time. Jaws is, I believe, earlier.
Yes.
75.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the beginning of the real, like, blockbuster. I mean, a lot. It was very
coined. The term was coined for Jaws.
Right. And then this is also post-Star Wars, obviously, although they were shooting probably contemporaneously.
I love it that it's obviously, for anybody reading this, it's like, well, of course, Star Wars, you know, 77. It's not, like, just the basic, it's the basic lifeblood. Right. Yeah, come on.
And then the, I was thinking the other thing that came up to me, I was thinking about during this was Star Trek, the Motion Picture.
Yeah.
Which is after this.
It's after this, but that one's sort of informed more, I think, spiritual, at least, by 2001, which is way earlier.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I'll give you that. So there's a lot happening, and I read some of the background on Wikipedia about this, and like this is one of those movies that was in development for a super long time. It went through various directors, went through various writers. They cast, you know, they looked at a bunch of different people for the main role. There's a lot of interesting back and forth. It's sort of one of those tortuous like paths to actually coming out into the theater, and it's right. I'll say this, you know, it's just to like introduce my own perspective on this. I didn't see this until fairly late. I don't think I saw this till I was an adult. And
well, so one thing that people forget is that Nick Cage was once attached to this project, and there was a giant mechanical spider in it.
Yeah,
that's how messed up this project was. He was
14 at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, the Coppola connection. So I saw this as an adult, so for me it doesn't necessarily hold the same position of reverence, just because I don't have a lot of nostalgia about it. I'm almost positive I saw it in the theater.
I don't actually remember going to see it, but unlike, you know, Star Wars, I distinctly remember going to see Star Wars only partially because the film broke just as the X-Wings were diving down the and we had to come back a week later to see how it ended.
Oh, that explains that your constant baseline level of anxiety.
You see?
Just when things are getting great.
Related to flying.
Right.
Oh, I have a comment about that based on this movie, but I can leave it till later.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot. I mean, Superman is full of that, right? Every single introduction of Superman has to involve some sort of hair disaster, which is always fun for me.
He's got,
but I was never super into, we keep saying that. I was never like crazy into Superman. I did watch the George Reeve show as a kid, but he wasn't like my favorite or anything. I think Batman was always probably more my favorite in general. I remember going to this, and I remember, I don't remember the specifics, but I remember that I did go to see it and thinking that it was really good.
Yeah. Superman is that it's almost timeless, right? The likability of Superman. I don't like words like that, like a likability, like electability. It's garbage.
Superman's very electable, let's be clear.
I would elect him in a second. Are you kidding? Except he's not allowed to be
not
president
born in this country.
I know. Yeah. You guys really got to change that. That's a dumb rule.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. probably. I mean, you could elect me, so, you know.
Beware.
Right, exactly. Superman suffers the same issue, regardless of what time you find him and when you come to him, is that he is the ultimate being, right? He's almost a Christ figure, which makes it less interesting
very much
to
so
tell
in this movie.
In most of the movies, right? Like, I'm going to give you my only son, and you're going to suffer for the sake of mankind. And I don't know if they use, I'm using mankind because I think that's exactly the word that they would use. But Superman is a sort of an uncomplicated character in many ways, and it makes it difficult to sort of write him well and to have him capture the imagination and to have you be able to relate to the character. Not that I can relate to Bruce Wayne particularly, but there's at least like a vulnerability there, right? Like there's something there. Like he's
broken.
He's broken. He can't just take a bunch of bullets. He's as we get into this movie, we'll see basically how Superman is effectively invulnerable, really. So,
I think that's in some ways, I was thinking a lot as I watched this about the now popular conception of Superman as we see him, and how much of it is drawn from this movie. from things like small things like I was thinking this is, I think, the first place that we ever see the whole idea of the S as being a Kryptonian symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm fascinated because many other places have taken that now as part of the mythology, which is fairly late in the Superman, you know, establishing his core. But also
that's a very clever idea.
It is. I always found it a little ridiculous, but it's fine. I'll let go.
Was ridiculous that it was a symbol.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly an S. It's clearly an S that stands for Superman. Let's not belabor this point.
It just happens to look like an S. That's not...
And they just happen to name him Superman. Yeah, that's fine.
Well, wait, no. But...
Well, she probably wondered why he had a big S on his chest.
It ain't hope.
That's it, because the glyph to them, theoretically, includes the shield that encompasses the S, right?
Right.
Right. Right. It's the whole thing. It's not just the S.
I know.
Right. And so to her... She just sees an S, but anyway, whatever.
Like, I like it way more and think it is a much more palatable explanation than the dude walks around wearing a big S on his chest because he's Superman.
Yeah.
Like you come to the stage thinking you're going to be named Superman. I mean,
that's a bit of a dick move.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. I think it's the fact that it's such a transparent retcon that just makes my eyebrows go up a little bit, but like, it's fine. Yeah. I'm not gonna,
but that's okay. I mean, there's so many better things to worry about in this movie than like,
sure. Yes, I guess my point was, again, I think so much of the, not just the mythology around him, but the way that we conceive of him as a character is drawn from this portrayal. I think more than most of the other portrayals, and it's certainly the one I think that's emblazoned most on certainly popular culture of that era, probably up through at least, you know, the mid-90s or so, when you start to get like there's a cartoon on and stuff like that before you really get around to the actual new cinematic or TV versions. I might throw Lois and Clark in there too, because that was another, for me anyways, that was kind of my formative Superman experience. But
which was cute. I liked it.
Yeah. But yeah. I
remember
think...
Remember when Terry Hatcher could break the internet?
But I think
it took 3 days to uncode, 3 days to download, and like an hour and a half you decoding it. Does Dad even know what we're talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Okay. I was going to say...
I don't.
But... Oh, you don't? No, oh, so Terry... Terry Hatcher wrapped in an American flag as a part of a photo shoot to support Lewis and Clark, which is...
I remember that.
Was it a flag or was it the cape? I thought it was the cape.
Oh, sorry. Same thing.
That makes more sense. Yeah. Right.
American flag / Superman cape. Same difference.
Yeah.
That was the modern day Kim Kardashian.
Right.
Yeah. That was the reference. Yeah. That was a big deal. Like, that made newspapers at the time.
Yeah. Well,
I'm not looking that up right now.
Yeah.
Anyways, just beyond even just the little details, but like the perception of him as a character and the most important parts of his origin story, because I think a lot of that then gets rehashed in other places. Like for me, for example, in a lot of the, I feel like in a bunch of the other versions of the Superman origin story, like Pa Kent does not die, which is, you know, put down here very much as sort of a major character moment. And I think that's not necessarily the case in a lot of other ones. It feels a little more like, you know, other, I had a note about this, but like, you know, a little bit Bruce Wayne-y, right? Like can't save his parents. It's a little bit Peter Parker, right? Like he's got these powers, but he can't save his dad or his adopted dad or whatever. And, you know, I think that's there's some interesting shifts in terms of how this characterizes what we understand of the Superman story.
Right, but I think that's a very clever... This movie... I think that one of the reasons that this movie serves as a template for Superman going forward is those kind of choices. They underscore right sort of at the beginning. We need to talk about which version you watched, because I had a lot more of this than I think you guys did. But they underscore his hopelessness, even in... even he can't act to save his father's life in that moment.
Yeah. And that informs his decision later.
True.
When he decides, screw it. I'm, you know, they're my original old man is putting all these rules on me, and I'm not gonna
right yeah.
stuff
I'm
it, old man.
Put up with it.
Yeah,
yeah, it exactly. You're not the boss of me.
Yeah,
and you're not my father. I mean, technically,
I'm going back in time. And
yeah, which is interesting.
Saving my girlfriend.
Yeah, and the you know, it's a little heavy-handed, but Pa Kent dies basically telling him, like, you were put on this earth to do more than just score touchdowns.
Right, right.
Which I loved. I thought that was heavy-handed. But I, like, that Pa Kent speech was great, I thought. He's like, look, you can't be... He did better than Kevin Costner, is what I guess what I'm trying to say. But he's like, yeah. You know, right. He's like, look, you know, you're showing off again. You can't be showing off. And Clark's like, well, why shouldn't I just celebrate all my capabilities? And Jonathan Kent ends up basically has the pitch of like, you can be all you can be, but you shouldn't be doing it just to like walk over everybody. Yes, you can. What's the point? Every time you get that ball, you can score. Who cares? Why do that? What, like, why take that away from those people?
Yeah, it's very. Yeah. It does have that aspirational DNA in it, in a way that I think a lot of others don't. And I think it's interesting too because it also feels, and especially towards the ending, this new movie feels kind of balanced on a knife's edge between like the end, you know, the end of sort of the hopeful era, like especially because it portrays that the Smallville segment is very. You know, it's they mention in the Wikipedia article even that it's supposed to convey sort of a Norman Rockweller, and yes. That often gets simplified in terms of what it means. You know, Rockweller is more complicated than that, but it's providing an idyllic look at small town, you know, rural American life, and
yes.
as right. a direct counterpoint to the stuff that we see in the city later on, which is much more modern, and mm-hmm. that feels like a represented balance also in this like. Society change over from like, you know, the 50s era to the, like, you know, think about the fact that the Tim Burton's Batman is like 10 years after this. It's very different take, very different tone. And this feels like it doesn't have a lot of the cynicism / sarcasm like that. I think what we get with a lot of later superhero movies, there's an earnestness to it still, except that little bit at the end, I think, is a foreshadowing of sort of the darker superhero stuff to come, which I think is it's a very little bit of that, but like it's there. There is some
when he screams.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's that's a big shift moment right there. And it was kind of interesting to see that where that is sort of the balance point for a lot of what comes later.
So I think that's astute. I think, two things. A, if do not readers, right off Norman Rockwell, fascinating guy, fascinating subject matter.
His museum is out here, and I've been there a couple times, and it's great. It's fascinating.
It's not just apple pie. It's he's a very, very fascinating guy.
Right.
The second thing is like the 80s are a bit of an interesting decade. Mm-hmm. Like it's not just like it was 10 years later in terms of superhero movies. Like between 78 and 88. Little bit happened.
Yeah, a couple things.
You know, like, that was, you know, by 89, when the Batman movie came out, the world was a very different place than it was in 78. And in 78, I think you could still look back 20, 30 years to the 50s, which is effectively what Smallville is, right?
Yeah.
But by the 80s, I think, especially in New York and, like, Metropolis, that had been lost to you. I don't think you could tell the same story that you could hear as you did then. Even in this one, they've got a rando guy, mugger, holding people at gunpoint. But at least then the mugger had a sports coat and
he's
a turtleneck. He's got a blazer.
That's what I know. I love a mugger with a blazer.
I know. He's so classy.
You gotta dress for work, guys. Come on. You got, you know, dress for the job you want, which is mugging people in the 1970s.
Yeah, I love it.
You just want to keep mugging people.
I do like the...
He wants to manage muggers.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, we're about to get into it because I'm about to start talking about those intrepid detectives that chase him down into the metro.
All right. Well, let's do a quick. Oh, yeah. Let's not get too bogged down. But so this movie's divided into basically three main parts. So
first of all, I watched Superman: the movie, which I think had a lot more.
Maybe talk about version.
All right, there are a few different versions. I believe that there is. Guy, did you watch the 3-hour version?
2.5 hours, 2 hours 23 minutes.
Okay, I think that's the same one.
I don't know how long the one that I watched was.
I had a lot of stuff on Krypton.
It did have a scene that I did not remember, which was
me too.
Going to talk to Jor-El after I forget exactly what, having his hot date with Lois, and Jor-El tells him that he needs to keep a secret identity and needs to keep it on the,
on the DL.
Keep her on
the back burner, I don't think my version had that.
Yeah, and I didn't remember that scene, frankly, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And it seems slightly clumsy, and it seemed like a scene that they totally would have cut.
Mine started with Zod on trial.
Yes, mine did start with that.
But did you have a comic book opening?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't remember that. Which I find kind of interesting. I watched it.
I did. I don't remember that at all.
I didn't really remember it either. I forget it every time. And then when I do remember it, I think it's more narrative, an explanation of how Superman was invented.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And it's not. It's like some kid
reading a comic
sort of
book.
Talking about
Metropolis.
But talking about it as if it's real, right?
Yeah, it's a little strange.
Yes.
Yeah, there are.
Was never in the one I remembered as a growing up. It seems a latter day edition, which is fine.
I think it's always there.
There was always there.
I think it's just the kind of thing that you forget.
There was a restoration in 2000, which added, it sounds like 8 minutes, but there were a lot more filmed, I think. It's hard to say. I was trying to read this and it was a little thorny, but basically. There was a theatrical version, and then when they released it for TV versions, there was more footage that could be added optionally by TV networks who wanted to run it. And there was a 3-hour 8-minute version that had been locked down prior to being re-edited for theatrical release. So there was 45 minutes longer than I think the theatrical version, which is a lot.
I got a lot more Mulholland than I signed up for.
Yeah, so, and that's the first thing I want to say about this, which was, Marlon Brando gets top billing in this movie, which is a heck of a fascinating look at the 1970s film system.
Yeah.
Right. Gene
Hackman, Marlon Brando.
Gets second billing, and they're both above the title.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Christopher
rightfully
Reeves
so, though.
Third.
They're big names. Yes, if you're gonna,
but Superman is the guy. It's about Superman.
But he was,
yeah, but no,
yeah. He only shows up in about half the movie.
Pretty well unknown.
He was unknown.
Making a superhero movie at the time was a liability.
Yes,
same as making a Star Wars movie, a liability. These guys, they came out of the 70s. They were making hard boiled detective stuff. The 70s were an incredible era for film, obviously. And to go and make a Superman movie or to go and make a Star Wars movie is kind of bananas, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of don't blame them for putting the CEO for putting these two big name actors up front. Just okay, look, I know it's a silly Superman movie, but we've got Marlon Brando calling it Krypton. So
I had that in my notes as well.
Krypton. does not care. Does not give a hoot.
He's not gonna learn your way of saying it.
And we've got, Margot Kidder is seventh credited, and I think the first woman credited. And then I love that Terrence Stamp is in there just to basically, so they shot most of Superman 2 back to back with this. And Terrence Stamp is
but
there.
It didn't
for,
come
like,
out for another 2 years.
Yeah, they. Although the end of mine said next year, Superman 2, which I thought was the original teaser. It's kind of the Bond will return in thing.
That's a ballsy move because I didn't.
Buckaroo Banzai will return.
Yeah. Right.
That's sort of ballsy though because uh, I It feels like it was uncommon in that era to just green light more than one movie at a time.
Yeah, it was. And in fact, they had, so apparently Mario Puzo, who was...
Well, he wrote The Godfather. So basically just give that guy a blank check. And
well, here's the thing. He wrote a 500-page script, which if you know anything about the
it's
way
one page
work,
a minute,
it's about a page a minute. So that would be huge. Apparently a lot of that was thrown out.
Yeah, I hope so.
And was rewritten largely by a guy named Tom Mankiewicz, who was never credited as a writer because of crediting rules, and basically rewrote it and got a creative consultant credit. And he came up with the...
Yeah, I was going to say, because he was in... His name was in the
yes
credits when I saw it.
And he came up with the Kryptonian crest thing, too. So you can trace that all back to him, apparently.
All right. Nice. Good
move. But yeah, so there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes here, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But the thing I wanted to sort of draw out here is that they talk about, and I think it's true, there's like three different segments, right? You've got the Krypton segment at the beginning, you've got the Smallville segment in the middle, and then you've got the Metropolis segment. And the Krypton segment, I agree with you, guy. Like, there's a lot. It's long. It's like 15 to 20 minutes before we get off Krypton. And it's a little strange because we both open with the fact that, like, it kind of feels like Jor-El is actually a prosecutor in that first scene, which is a little strange because then in the next scene, we have the traditional, like, he's a scientist warning everybody that the world's going to blow up. And you're like,
he's a scientist prosecutor.
He's a prosecutor. He's a scientist. He's a dessert topping. He's a floor wax. Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's, you know, their world failed for a reason.
And so my first question, though, was like, I wondered if audiences has had any idea what was going on here. Did they think for like, because like, not much is said for the first few minutes and he's there wearing the S and you're like, do they think he's just like old Superman?
Can we back up for just 1 second, though, because we alluded to the credits, but I think the opening credits in this movie and, you know, the John Williams theme are so dramatic that going in to see that movie and having that be the beginning, I think I almost now that I think about that, I think I remember that because that was, I was like, wow, this is loud and like very dramatic, like, and something big is about to happen.
Do you like lasers,
the text
John?
Treatment, like they're flying through space, like
I hope, because that I'd never seen before.
I hope you like lasers, because there are a lot of lasers in those credits.
There's some real bad special effects. I mean, just you know, he's flying through space, just have us like a couple sparklers.
I have to say that the text treatment on the like the laser text treatment thing is one of those classic ideas of like, we just discovered this technique and we're going to use it a lot.
but funny, because
then the first thing that he says is, this is no fantasy, no careless product of wild imagination, which is like trying to like ground you into the movie, right? I mean, it's not, you know, it's technically supposed to be about the crimes committed by Zod, but it's really to the viewer saying, no, this is like, this is not some crazy comic book story, this is real. Which of course it's not, but I mean,
well, it's, like, it's
come
trying
on,
to put
come on, join. It's like get on the bandwagon with
exactly
us.
Put on your Brainiac. It's the 1970s film hat. Like, you know, like don't stop throwing popcorn down your face and take this one seriously, I guess, is what they're trying to say.
Which I'm sure was a lot easier in the 1970s than it was watching it from like 40 years later. The whole first scene's not bad, but as soon as the Jor-El shows up in his reflective bike costume, it feels like a bit chintzier.
I like the sort of whatever it was.
That is made of the same materials that the film screens are made of, the projector screens.
Oh, and what, they would shine like light on them?
Yeah, they accidentally discovered that it lit up and they're like, this looks great, let's cut it up and put it on costumes.
Oh, that's amazing. I was watching with my friend last night and she asked how do they do that effect, and I'm like, I don't know, let's just watch the movie. Like, I made a mental note to like, okay, I guess I better ask Todd or something. So that's fascinating. They accidentally used the same sort of material.
They found out while they were testing it that it reflected light in that way, and they thought it looked so cool that they wanted to put it on the costumes.
It did. It was amazing. It looked very alien.
It is. It feels very much like what Tron accomplished through, you know,
digital.
Not digital, but like VFX when in fact it was just shooting off of reflective.
A lot of the sort of look and just the filming feel of what happens on Krypton reminds me of Logan's Run.
Mm.
Ooh, another interesting,
another contemporaneous, right? That's in the mid-70s.
Yeah, right. Which came out around the same time.
Yeah. Oh, like in that everybody's wearing tinfoil, basically.
Then just like when they're falling, it's very similar to what happened. You know what it looks like in Carousel when everyone's getting like blown up.
And you can see a lot of the impact that. I mean, again, not stuff that's directly impacting since this was in production, you know, around the time Star Wars came out. But like my notes were like, we open on Hoth, you know, like the model work, a lot of that stuff feels very much, it is of the same era, right? So like the same thing with people falling or camera shaking and stuff like that all feels very much of that 70s, late 70s.
Oh man, sci-fi. I feel
it's trippier
Hoth is
though.
Like,
it's way trippier than Star Wars.
Sure,
for sure,
I agree with you 100%, but like it's, it has a filmmaking quality around it that is similar, but like also I think pales a little bit in comparison.
Hoth is night and day better. I think I still like this. It's cool, but Hoth is maybe I'm.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hoth felt more real. Hoth felt a lot more real.
So we have the whole Phantom Zone thing, which I think is worth mentioning, if only because of the fact that they did film back to back with Superman 2, because that's all set up for a movie that isn't this movie, right? Like, which is a little strange. Mm-hmm. It's like a 5-minute scene that it will not be important for 2 more years.
Yeah.
And then it also is as an explanation for, like, you know, all that stuff. It's very, I feel like most Superman origin story stuff, he really opens with like Jor-El telling everybody that the world's going to blow up and nobody believes him. So it was an interesting choice to draw in what feels in retrospect, like kind of disjointed in terms of why is this character involved in this? Who are these people, et cetera? It's an interesting choice.
He's the Greta of his time.
I was just about to make that joke. That is the Greta Jor-El is she's a real hero. She's up for a Nobel Peace Prize, which is gonna be great. We can put that in the rocket ship with Kal-El.
Exactly,
fire him off. You know,
I will call out my two favorite bits, two favorite lines from Brando. One is, "This planet will explode in 30 days, if not sooner," which feels like a offer to deliver your pizza in a certain amount of time. And when he says, "Fine, like neither I nor my wife will leave Krypton," I'm like, "Oh, nice loophole there, Jor-El."
Yeah.
Oh man, I don't know if you guys,
the police guards who never seemed to follow up on that. I mean, I guess it was too late, the planet blew up. But they're like Jor-El's up to something. Well, go get him, and then they never make it.
Yeah, well, they make a bigger deal out of that in their sort of slash remake that they did, which is it turns into Avatar for a bit, which is fine, but not my cup. You don't need that. Mm-hmm. The thing that did bug me that made it very very 70s is while they're putting Kal-El into the pod, Jor-El gives this long speech about his father and his son and his love. And poor Superman's mom just hangs out there, not saying a word. And it's like, come on.
Also, you're telling him all this stuff that he'll never...
in Superman Returns.
He'll never remember any of this either.
Yeah.
I also will call out, again, in terms of like modern, how it, the feel and the look. I feel like this was also the origin of like all the crystalline aesthetic of Krypton.
He had the Fortress of Solitude up north for you guys in the Arctic for anybody else.
It's still north, guy.
Down the street from you.
It's up north for me. I guess it's up north for me and in the Arctic for you guys. Yeah, it's just up the road from where we live. Sam Kirk, we need a penguin at the North Pole, Fortress of Solitude. Thanks, buddy. So the notion of ice and crystals was part of the Superman mythos before this, but it being a technology unto itself is, as far as I know, unique or originated with this film.
Yeah.
Specifically throwing that crystal and growing a fortress was like kind of wacky. Yeah.
Which also comes back in Superman Returns.
Yeah.
But I think didn't the Doomsday Bomb in Beneath the Planet of the Apes have some sort of crystalline activity, you know, like not an activation button. Something like that. It was either like, maybe it was just clear plastic, but I always think of that as a cousin to this.
So around that time, and this is going a little bit off topic, but around that time, quartz watches and crystals were becoming introduced a new wave of technology in terms of timepieces.
Yeah.
So the notion of crystals as a conduit for high technology was Oberon, you know? Yeah.
It's a better way to show future technology than to just use like the best current technology you have.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, which is what most movies would have done.
It's funny that you mentioned the quartz crystal watch thing, Guy, because I think one thing, as I was just sort of writing up some notes and watching the credits, is I think it said watches provided by Timex at the very end.
Yeah, she looks at her watch. I noticed that was very prominent at one point where Lois looks at her watch and it says Timex on it.
I wonder if that was more of a conscious thing than that's a great point. I'd never thought about that.
Interesting.
That could be kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So wait, I'm looking at this now. 80s. Yeah, they were introduced right around that time. Like quartz.
Sorry, I could easily see somebody quickly, in development thinking like, ooh, crystals are technological or whatever.
Yeah,
run with it.
First one was in 1927, but around that time, 69,
it got cheap enough
So by the 70s, it was becoming a real thing. Yeah.
That was the parent of one of the technology B-Squad people from Arrow.
So we have our traditional inverse sort of Moses myth with Kal-El getting put into the rocket and sent out into space. It's very crystalline here again, as opposed to a lot of other ones, which, you know, make it look a little bit more like a spaceship. And we also have an interesting choice here, which I agree with. I can't remember when you mentioned 2001 before. This sex sequence feels very 2001, where we have, you know, Kal-El being going through space. And we have all these like facts being thrown at the baby face about like all these galaxies and whatever. And it like seems like the kid just gets 3 years older because it takes that long, but I guess never needs to drink or eat. So that's fine.
Well, he's on life support and he falls asleep listening to science podcasts, which is probably, if you're going to fall asleep listening to something, probably do that.
Does that have any effect? Does he remember any of that?
Marlon Brando's podcast.
Yeah. So the other night, I swear to God, and I don't want to admit this to our D-readers and this, especially to you, but the other night I fell asleep watching Ancient Aliens or whatever it was. about I needed to sleep and it put me to sleep. Okay. I'm not ashamed.
Where were you watching this?
It was like I went to bed and I just pressed play on YouTube like on
YouTube. Right?
I'm worried about
it was on Netflix, but same.
I was gonna say I'm worried about what other autoplay videos like have you
In my sleep I'm getting slowly turned into a Nazi.
Very Manchurian candidate.
Right.
So we have this whole long thing leading up into him crashing to Earth and meeting Ma and Pa Kent. And again, what appears to be, and this is where I wondered if they were going with that framing story at the beginning, because they referenced the Depression and the aesthetic. I mean, their truck and the way Pa Kent dresses look very kind of 40s, 50s.
Yeah,
which is like, I have my first
suit. I love it.
Right. I had my first moment of like, when is this movie?
Yeah,
but it's timeless. It's middle America. It's
roughly 20 years before 78, right?
Yeah, so, you do the math later, and it actually kind of works, which is a little bizarre. Yeah. But there's some weird, like you assume the kid is 3, and then there's like a whole thing where he goes to the Fortress of Solitude and goes to space for 12 years, sort of.
Yeah, and then there's weird, like Jor-El says that he's been dead for thousands of years, and when they're talking about the meteorite, it's. Krypton supposedly blew up 45 years ago.
Here's the thing. I had that same question about the thousands of years, and my friend told me that, hey, that's how relativity works.
It is.
Dummy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of the Krypton blew up 45 years ago relative to our time, or right. 1,000 years ago, but the asteroids hit before Kal-El hit, so I don't know. It's plausible.
That's not
my biggest complaint.
I'm not expecting scientific accuracy from this.
Oh, yeah, I have a whole list of things later where it's like, this is not how this works.
Yeah. Well, also, Jor-El keeps talking about like the 28 known galaxies.
Yes.
Which is like...
And later he says 26, so whatever.
Well, no, he just forgot a couple.
Yeah,
that's all. It could be the ones that they've explored, you know?
Can I ask a question? This is the thing that made me a little, like... I had my moment of, what? In this, which is when the... pod crash lands and
I know what you're gonna say.
Why is there, how did you get away with having a fully
a naked child
on the screen?
Because get over yourselves, come on.
It was first of all, it was back then and people were less concerned about,
I guess. It was just it struck me
you
as
probably shouldn't be now. Whatever. It's a naked child. That's life.
Okay.
Get over it.
All right.
The fact that there's creeps out there should not, whatever.
I think it's worth noting in that it's something that no film would ever see today.
No, but this is a mainstream film in the 70s, which is, while you're holding it up as a, so to speak, as a weirdness from the past, I'd make the argument that the weirdness is now.
That's not unreasonable. I think it made me pause and like kind of be like, that's again, I think probably because that was
you
not
were surprised.
Think,
you were surprised.
I think
to see
what
it.
Is interesting is the difference, is what I'm saying.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There's a difference there, and you know, I don't think there's any. Whatever.
It certainly draws more parallels to sort of religious imagery, though, I feel like, because if you are doing something like a nativity or a you know, Moses in the basket or whatever, like there's definitely a stronger image parallel to that. So I can see it from that standpoint. If that's sort of part of what you're trying to convey, it makes a lot more. It was the question of the choice was all that I just was puzzled about, because
so you are 100% right, they would never ever make that choice today. Now it would be far too risky. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, and to be clear, I'm not pro, this is not something that I'm eager to see, but on the other hand, I don't get it.
I also think it's like you don't really need it.
That's true.
You could have shot head like a close up shot, and it like wouldn't have changed anything, right? Like it wouldn't.
That is true. I don't think you need it. On the other hand, I don't necessarily think it was bad.
I'm not saying bad. It just again, it was it took me by surprise because of where we, you know, of the current cultural climate and just the way stuff gets shot, where you just.
And I don't think I would have. I mean, having seen it in 78 and, you know, and then a number of times after that, I mean, I don't think it was probably until like the 90s where I started thinking, that's a little weird or like unusual.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be fair, there were a lot of things that are very, very much categorically bad that would have passed in the 70s.
Sure.
Yeah.
That until like the 90s, 2000s. Like, I'm sure that we would have been like, oh, that's fine.
In this movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Some are subtly our prime minister of Canada. So, you know, like there's.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
All right. So we have Clark lifting the truck, and then we fast forward to the high school where like Clark is basically the team manager cleaning up everything because he can't play football. And we touched on this a little bit. I did want to note my one thing where I think the guy who plays young Clark Kent, who is not Chris Reeve, looks a lot to me like Armie Hammer, but with like a bad wig. It's like, Armie Hammer. Oh, he'd be a good Superman.
I think he's pretty good, though.
He's not bad. I don't love him,
I think he's good in the, I mean, I think back then they probably put more of a premium on someone who looked more like him.
So, ironically,
but I think it works out pretty well.
Apparently, all of his lines were redubbed by Chris Reeve.
Was that right?
Yep. And apparently, they were like a little. He was a little peeved about that for a while.
Okay.
Which is a weird choice, but okay, I kind of see why. Fine. I also thought it was an interesting choice. I mean, I guess I could have seen an era where he, you know, you could have gotten away with having Chris Reeve try to play a teenager, but probably fine he didn't.
Yeah.
I don't like him as much as Christopher Reeve, I think.
No,
but I don't think you're supposed to. Christopher Reeve is Christopher Reeve pulls magic tricks in this movie.
Yeah, we'll get there. We're not quite there yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah. Are you sure? We're only 46 minutes in.
Well, we covered a bunch of this. We talked a little bit about his dad. Yeah.
I'm going to stop having to comment on every scene. This movie is brilliant. I like it so much.
It really is. I mean, there's a lot. I still have a lot of notes here.
Yeah, we could do a whole season just on this movie.
He looks really crazy, running fast.
Yep.
Oh, it's the worst. Oh, it's the worst
so bad. Effect. It's unbelievably bad, really. It's like, just lean forward more and you will look much better. But anyway, so Lois Lane is in the train.
Oh, is she?
That's Lois, because her mother says, oh, Lois, you know, you've got such a wild imagination. So Lois sees him running, you know, running fast. And her mother is the woman who played Lois Lane in the TV show.
George Reeves. Yeah. That's pretty good. My notes on this one, we talked a little bit about the whole, like, can't save his dad. I have to note that Clark totally kills his dad by making him right.
Which I was like, I don't think I really thought of that until this viewing. I was like, he shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
he's got a heart condition.
This is also a very 70s movie in that there are a lot of very we're all used to super quick cut, lots of shots, and that is not this movie, right? There's a lot of long lingering shots on things like Clark standing in the cornfield.
That crane shot is great, though.
It's a really nice shot. I think it's interesting again to view from the perspective today, because I think it's something that audiences don't have as much of a patience for, and that's neither here nor there. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing, but it's an interesting to watch the choices made by the filmmaking of that era, that those were things. And it makes me think of things like hearkening back to more classic movies, like, I don't know, I thought of, you know, Sound of Music or Wizard of Oz or stuff like that, where there seems to be more of a different aesthetic, but it feels more of that ilk of filmmaking in some ways. And again, I think that's talking to, like, its sort of balance point between older movies and the blockbuster modern movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Clark decides to go to the Arctic. He throws a glow stick and builds a house. I wish I could do that. That'd be pretty awesome. we get his, my notes, it says Marlon Brando's floating head takes Clark to an IMAX movie for 12 years.
It's very strange.
Because he goes to space and he, I guess, learns a lot of stuff.
Yeah, does he go to space or does he just go tripping balls for 12
years? I think he goes tripping balls for 12 years.
He makes it seem like it's either an allegory or they literally go.
I think it's an, I don't know. It's weird because there are things that feel like they need to happen in those 12 years that are probably not covered. Like, you know, getting a journalism degree, like establishing a work history, any of those things. But it's like, nope, we're just going to make you watch
He set up a fake online college.
And then we have our, like, the Jor-El speech where he's like, you know, literally like, I'm giving you my only son, right? Like, heavy on the Christ allegory.
Yeah. I am literally a disembodied holographic head. They should have just put a burning bush in front of that guy, is all I'm saying.
Or had James Earl Jones voice him. One of those.
One or the other. Yeah. Wait, no. Was it? No.
I was thinking Lion King.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway.
And then it ends with him already basically in the Superman costume, which is also one of those, like, I guess, again, of an era where it's like, wait, where did he get that? Why does he have it? Like, I've got a lot of questions. It's fine. It's not something I'm going to worry about. But I will note that it's about 48 minutes in before you get your first look at Christopher Reeves / Superman, which is a long time.
Which is about where we are in this podcast.
Yep. I think we're longer. But let us move on to the last sort of the biggest segment of this movie, which is the Metropolis stuff. Because I think that's the real meat of it. And I think, you know, we'll take a moment here to discuss Christopher Reeve, who is, I think we can all agree, freaking amazing and the best part of this movie.
Yeah.
Christopher Reeves is an underappreciated talent. I think everybody thinks of him as Superman, as Clark Kent. It's true. He's great in Clue. He was a hilariously great physical comedic actor. And I don't think he could have pulled this off.
Is he in Clue?
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah, I'm gonna bet you a dinner on it, because just I like going to dinner with you anyway. Can't go wrong with that.
Cool. This is a good podcasting right here.
No, just you.
Yeah. Okay. You so this. Anyway, you so you go look it up and decide
I'm
whether or not
I'm looking.
Yeah,
it up.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing.
He's not in Clue, guys. Sorry, you lose.
Yeah, I didn't think he was in Clue.
What's
he's
he in?
But he's in another. He's in another movie like that. He's in another murder mystery. What's
Death
that
Trap?
Murder mystery one?
Death Trap.
Yeah, he's in Death Trap.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So guess what? I owe you dinner, and you fell into my Death Trap. Yeah. Long story short, Christopher Reeves is amazing. Clark Kent is Clark Kent. Superman is Superman. In one particular scene, we see him transform and then transform back.
Which is great.
He's amazing. He is a tall, strapping, incredibly handsome man. And yet, he can carry himself as a complete doofus at one second, and then in the next second, you can 100% believe him that he is the ultimate. He is the Man of Steel.
Clark is such a creeper.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
Clark is a total, like, there are times when he's just sitting at his desk staring at Lois. It's so uncomfortable.
Here's the thing.
And then Superman is smooth.
Yeah. No. Superman is also...
Like, you want me to check out your underwear? I'll check out your underwear.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a little bit of a creeper move too, but she did invite him.
Oh, yeah. She put that on the table.
She put it on the table. But the funny thing is, it's like, she expects it in the moment, and then he can't because he has to reveal like the inability to see through lead. And then as soon as she moves away, he's like, "Oh, the pink." I totally checked that out.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of that. I think he is incredible in performing both of those sides of it and really making you actually kind of understand how you could be mistaken about these not being the same person.
The posture shift that he does in that
And the voice he changes a bunch too, which is impressive. So I the story in Wikipedia about this is really interesting, because he was fairly far down because he was, like we said, basically unknown, and there were a ton of people who were, you know, offered this part, including people like Robert Redford, Burt Reynolds, Paul Newman. Like they cast Patrick Wayne, John Wayne's son, at one point, but he had to drop out. People who lobbied for this role included Arnold Schwarzenegger and Neil Diamond.
Wow.
They approached James.
Oh man, Arnold
Khan,
Schwarzenegger would have been a huge.
James Brolin, Chris Walken, Nick Nolte, John Voight.
James Caan. James Caan would have been hilarious.
He said he was offered the part but turned it down because he couldn't wear the suit.
Well, I think at the time he might have been living at the Playboy Mansion, drinking like four bottles of wine a day, and you know.
I want to say that my favorite choice. So DC asked for a list of actors that were to be considered from Superman and approved the producers' choices of the following people, who I think are fascinating in a variety of ways: Dustin Hoffman, Clint Eastwood, Steve McQueen, James Caan, Al Pacino, and my personal favorite, and the one that if I couldn't have Christopher Reeve, I want to live in the world where this happened, Muhammad Ali.
Oh.
Wow.
Wow. Holy cow.
Yeah, right? Like, that would have been a very, very different take on this, and I would be here for it. And it's fascinating, again, when we talk about
back in 78, they were
better off than we were now, right?
Yes,
in some ways. I guess my point being, it is one of those other things. When you view it from the lens of today, you think to yourself, like, well, we moved backwards in some ways.
I don't know.
Wow. I don't know what gives you that impression.
Reeve was impressed apparently then when he did a screen test, but he was told to wear a muscle suit because he wasn't muscular enough, but he refused,
oh,
and he
God.
Basically
no.
got training from David Prowse, who you may know better as the guy inside the Darth Vader costume. David Prowse wanted to portray Superman, but was denied an audition because he wasn't American. And he also auditioned.
Oh my God.
He also auditioned for Nan, who he didn't end up playing either. The
guy who plays Nan is great. I don't know how you could. I mean, I don't. Maybe they could all be great, but that guy is spectacularly. He's really great at being apish. You know.
Yeah, I thought for a minute it was what's his name? Richard Kiel? Is that his name?
Richard Kiel. Yeah,
but it's not. Yeah. It just kind of looks like him.
Right.
Anyways, that's my Wikipedia download for you, because I thought that
Muhammad
was
Ali as Superman. The only downside of that would have been, all of the implicit racism that just
I would be a little afraid what they would do with it.
Well, I mean, even now, you know, it's like, hey, Idris Elba should
other
be
people. You mean people's reaction?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so yeah. Like even now, it's like Idris Elba as Bond. It's like he's. Basically said, like, you know what, I don't want to have to deal with all of the backlash on that, so.
But I kind of feel like there was the big but thing that's missing there is there was no internet in 1978, so I kind
of
feel
they
like,
could have got away with it. They could have done it. But here's the thing. Muhammad Ali is an inherently witty and hilarious person. He is a machine in the ring, and he is equal in repartee. And Superman is not.
Right.
Superman is the most milquetoast thing you could ever have. Yeah, and true. Muhammad Ali is not that thing. There's no way his personality couldn't bleed into like a sharp witted silver tongued Superman. Which is like cool. I would dig it, but it's not
the character really.
It's not.
Yeah. But so, I do want to peek into that alternate reality.
Oh yeah, for sure. Except like basically, Muhammad Ali is just taking Lewis to bed right there. He's not taking off into the moonlight. He's like, hey, we've been flying around, baby.
Oh yeah,
yeah. You like that flight? Will, like, hey, let's go for another
based
flight
on the,
right here.
The rest of that list, I think we dodged a number of bullets there.
Yes,
Chris Walken.
I'm
Superman.
But wait, no. Have you seen Chris Walken in the 70s?
I mean, still.
He is a incredibly sexy guy. Yeah, he's really good looking. No, I don't know what we're laughing about. I mean,
it's super weird.
His eyes. What? It's the eyes.
Yeah,
it's the eyes. The eyes are weird.
So, I just want to talk about, basically New York, Metropolis.
Is
New York, and that is my New York, because I grew up outside of the New York area, and that is what I remember from like every time that I would go into New York City with my parents. It's just like, it was exactly like that. And there's so many like great new, I mean, they just put a whole bunch of stuff in there that makes you, I mean, you know, they call it Metropolis, but you know, it's New York.
Yeah. Which is a shift. 'Cause I feel like, you know, so much of the disparity between Metropolis and Gotham was predicated on the fact that, like, it's not that Metropolis often gets identified with Chicago. I don't think that's necessarily a strong identification, not as strong as Gotham in New York. But it is the, like, it's the daytime, you know, New York, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But I think it is a different, it's a slightly different take of Metropolis than I think we see in a lot of other places.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a little grittier. It's got that 70s edge to it.
It felt
right?
it though. Like you could feel it. Like the shots that they did on the street felt apropos for the time.
Right.
They really did. They didn't feel like 10 years later, they were shooting Gotham in 1930s sets, which I loved. I like the aesthetic of it. But this was like, you know, when those detectives are chasing Otis, well, you know, following Otis, that feels like New York of the time.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. It literally is.
Yeah, it literally is.
And, you know, and Luther's lair is basically, I mean, there are always rumors of hidden
tunnels,
levels of Grand Central Station.
Yeah.
And it's basically what that is.
But I was going to say, the 70s edge to it feels of a time and place that a lot of times other superhero locales do not. Like, you know, I think of even the TV show Gotham, where... Mm. It's kind of a weird, timeless you know, there are computers, but they're old computers, and there's old TVs and old cell phones, right? Like everything in Gotham was very much. And the same thing with the Batman animated series, where everything
but
has the
The cars are from like the 70s.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but they have both embraced the myth of the character, and the character has been around since the late 30s, and it's like, screw it.
But
we don't need time. We need the story, and we'll make it work.
But again, I think it's a deliberate choice to bring Superman into the present day.
They grounded this movie a lot more in the current period.
Yeah. Which, back to your point, John, is that, what was the opening line? Like, this is not a story or myth.
Right. Exactly. They wanted to make, they clearly made a choice to make this seem like it was happening.
Right.
And the tagline, "You will believe a man can fly."
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, we're going to make this real, seem as real as possible, because they were afraid that if they didn't do that, then it would seem farcical.
I don't know. Was it being afraid, or was it, we're going to bring the 70s cinema verite thing to, Superman, the most unbelievable thing you can do. Like, if you see it from that perspective, isn't that the most audacious thing you could do? Like, not the French Connection, not the Godfather. It's like, hey, look, you know what? I'm going to take this hard-boiled cinema style, and I'm going to bring it to
Superman. When a cop gets killed.
It's very much like
one of those movies. Yeah,
and also that's right out of a James Bond movie. Like the villain sitting in his lair pushing some villains.
I had that in my list. I said Lex's introduction is basically a James Bond villain with the hand touching the button and all that. Yeah.
Did you guys love as much as I did that they reserve the reveal that he is a bald man
until the very end?
You see him with a skull cap on when he's swimming, and like there's a wig
bald until the last,
and he's wearing different wigs through several points. Yeah,
right. Yeah, yeah. Right. But it's great. It's I mean, the iconic, here's the thing. The iconic thing about that character is that he is bald.
Yes.
And they, of all the things to hold back from you as a viewer, it's Lex Luthor being bald. But they save that for the very last scene. That is some weird, and I love it, storytelling. Like, why? Why did you do that? I dig it, but it's
weird too, because you could understand it if you were like, Gene Hackman didn't want to shave his head. But he clearly did.
Yeah, right? I know. Like, yeah.
I'm pretty convinced he's not wearing like a bald cap. I think he's actually, it looked like he had shaved his head. So it's like, well, if you're going to do that, then you might as well. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah,
it's
I'm sure we could find out by looking on the internet, but I don't care. Whatever. He shaved his head.
So we have, there's a lot going on here. And again, we don't necessarily have time to go through all of it, but we get the introduction of Clark. Get him working at the Daily Planet. I guess he's got some qualifications, or it was the 70s and no one cared. We get the introduction of Otis and Lex.
Everybody was too busy trying to find the next Woodford and Bernstein that they're like, can you type? You know what I love? It's Perry White he sings Clark's praises, but most importantly, he's like, you know what? I've never seen anybody type any faster. Like that is quintessential newsroom. Like, don't care.
Yeah. Karen's editor, anytime like she would get in a, like a conversation with a coworker, Karen's editor would say, I don't want to hear you talking. I want to hear you typing.
Right. It's so basic. It's like, you're the city editor. Type stuff.
Yeah.
Get it in press. Print it. That's all I care about.
Also, the Daily Planet apparently has a helicopter taxi. So that's cool.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's New York.
The traffic's terrible.
I think newspapers may have gone down a little notch or two since this movie was made.
My favorite. Well, yeah. I mean, look at her apartment on a reporter's salary. Right. My favorite, what's the word I'm looking for? My favorite sort of reference or undercutting of a reference. And again, what's fascinating about this movie is that Superman is such a known character for everybody, right? And you know certain elements of his story and like just of his character, right? And so you get the scene where the helicopter is crashing and Clark needs to change into his superhero costume and he goes to the phone booth.
The phone booth.
And it's like the half phone booth thing. And of course, it's doubly funny now because
there wouldn't even be that.
And of course, he ends up doing it in a revolving door instead, which is, I think, a great scene. I really enjoy that. Yeah.
Do you know what? There was a scene later on that I think may have been cut from some releases that undoes that magic.
Is it the one where he's falling off the building and he changes?
Yeah, it jumps out and then
that's a little weird.
It crossfades.
That's shorthand for super speed changing clothes, but who knows?
Me too. But I had to. So there are things at the end of this movie that you need to make assumptions about in order to make sense. And I'm game for it because it's earned my trust in you know, but that didn't, it just visually didn't make sense.
It wasn't pulled off well.
No. Yeah. I need to make excuses about why that effect worked. And that's
right.
Along those lines, I love the total disregard for physics in how he catches the helicopter, which is that the helicopter has basically no mass as soon as he catches it.
Yeah. Right.
And he just lifts it gently back up. That's fine. That's the limitations of the special effects of the era. And there's only so much you could do. He also, we have our like our montage of him catching criminals at this point, because I guess like him saving Lois is the trigger to actually becoming Superman.
Expose himself.
Yeah.
Himself
out. As it were.
Last night when I was watching this, to be honest, I think about John most nights, but specifically, John, previously you brought up the fact that superheroes save people.
Yeah, and I have that note in here. Yeah, because in my book, like your super, if you have a superhero movie, your superhero should save people. And it's one of my big complaints about Batman, about Tim Burton's Batman, is he actually never saves anybody, because even that, I mean, his introduction, he just beats up the crooks. He doesn't even go into the alley to save the people who are basically in the same situation that he was in when he was a kid, and he just lets them get robbed, and then he beats the crooks up on the rooftop afterwards and leaves the money there.
Right. It's like more of a catharsis.
Completely
in that.
Wrong.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Are you guessing that Batman is self-involved?
Yeah. He still wins every fight, but you know.
Guy, I thought you were going to say the point was that that Superman tells Lois that flying is statistically the safest way to travel.
So there's a lot going on in this movie that basically, if we could just sit down with John, I don't know how it would go, because there is an awful lot of air trouble.
They repeat that joke in Superman Returns. He says exactly the same thing when he rescues her from the plane.
Yeah. It's the most all-American thing to say, right? Like,
It's interesting, too, because it gives us different... It finally starts to give us a picture of our Superman character versus our Clark Kent character, which is, this Superman is... He's not exactly quippy, but he is... He's always got kind of a line...
Bad vibrations. Man, is there a more 70s line than that?
That one is pretty terrible.
Here's what I love. Superman in this movie is... typically, the idea is that sort of Clark Kent is Superman. But in Superman in this movie is Clark Kent with the restraints lifted. This is the guy that would be cocky... running to the end zone and nailing a touchdown.
Right.
Like this is him with it's like, you know what? If there's nothing left limiting you, go for it. And you know, it's not like he didn't know that guy was sneaking up behind him with a crowbar, right? Like
That's very different from, for instance, how he was portrayed in the George Reeves show. Because he's like a big guy, and he's not like some simpering idiot. I think they do a few things where he can't like open a jar of pickles or something like that, but it's nowhere near as heavily portrayed. You know, the distinction is not so heavy as it is
opening the soda and exploding it, right?
Yeah.
Right. They really bifurcated. And in fact, they bifurcated from the point where young Clark is more integrated than I feel that older Clark is after those 12 years.
Yeah.
Like young. So
well, it's an act. I mean, you know, it's.
Yeah.
Right. And I referenced last week when we talked about it that I learned so much of my Superman stuff from that like trade paperback thing or mass market paperback. And there's a whole bit in there where he talks about learning to play Clark Kent and like playing mm-hmm. up the clumsiness and like the mild manneredness and all and adopting the slight hunch and all of that. And I always thought that was fascinating as a kid looking at it and realizing like, yeah, he's got to learn how to pretend not to be Superman because like Clark Kent as seen in, you know, as a teenager versus Clark Kent as an adult, there's a very different dynamic there that you're playing with. Like it's like anybody learning to sort of pretend to be a grown up, I think, in some ways.
Yeah. Yes. One of the things that's great about this movie is the practical effects that they do. A lot of the, like, you know, we've harped on some of the special effects, like the sparklers and, you know, the space stuff, the trippy space things. But, like, that when he is getting that crook that's on the climbing up the wall or the glass window, they built that set. So the guy that's in the office on the inside is, like, you know, he's on a wall and they're standing on top. The glass is like the root, the ceiling, and they're standing on top of it doing whatever, you know, just that little bit of it. And the guy is like tilted at 90 degrees and like facing down and pretending to work at the desk so that they could film it that way.
Also,
when he pushes the rocks, there's a few the rest of the thing looks so cheesy. It looks just like screaming train set, model.
Superman saves a model village is what I wrote.
Yeah, but him actually there, like when the rocks come down, when he's like actually just pushing the rocks, they must have just made like big papier-mâché rocks, and it looks decent, and then it looks ridiculous when it falls into the valley.
I do like that we briefly confuse Superman's power for Spider-Man's powers, where he can just stand on walls.
Right. No, but I mean, whatever. Well, he's Superman.
I know.
There's no limit to that. I love that. So that effect, there are a few effects that in this movie are incredible. I don't know how they did them. And you contrast that with like, hey, I'm Superman. I'm going to run next to the train.
Yeah,
right. That's horrible. But
I mean, those were 20 years earlier. Clearly, he was only a kid at the time.
He didn't know how to do the special effects.
They got technology at the time, right? Because they're filming. This is very 70s cinema veritas, right? So they're actually filming this guy grow up. Yeah. Right.
It's very Richard Linklater.
Right. That's exactly what it is. But no, that's. I think. Well, I know Todd Vaziri at one point had a giant Twitter stream of where Superman drops off Lois at her apartment and then Clark flies away and then Clark shows up and it's all one big tracking shot. It's brilliant. There are things in this movie that you don't think are brilliant that are executed beyond what I think most people would consider.
Yeah.
It's incredible, especially for the techniques available to them at the time.
And it makes up for the "Can you read my mind" thing,
right?
Poem. It makes you just gloss over that and think, okay, that was a mistake. But the rest of the movie is great.
That poem was killing me.
It's not bad.
It's not good.
I'm like one or two of them would have been okay, but it would have been like, you know what? Here's what kills me. Lois Lane is a professional writer. That is some high school poetry BS, right? Like that's, you get that from your seventh grade crush and you're like, ooh, I kind of know where you're going, but this feels really awkward.
I guess the idea is that, you know, he melts her so much because she's such a hard-boiled reporter because they allude to the things that she's writing and it's all about murder and rape and all this other stuff and she doesn't know how to spell the words, but that's what she writes about. But, you know, but the reason they say that she can't spell is in order for you to hear the words without reading the article. And so I guess the part of the point is that, oh my God, he's got had such an effect on her. He's turned her into like a 13-year-old, and which is, you know, a problem in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yes. A problem in itself. B, one or two lines would have sufficed.
Yeah.
I didn't need like a 3-minute thing with that. Yeah. Also, what I really didn't need is her holding, like, he's got it by the fingertips at one point.
Yeah.
And John, I know you paid attention to this. How did he lose his grip?
I don't know.
He's Superman. Also, you literally see him, like, later in the movie, he literally lifts up the San Andreas Fault and fixes the Earth from cracking itself apart. And he's like, this, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, 130-pound, 150-pound woman just slipped right out of my fingers.
Also, the flying with her is weird, and it's, like, not how flying works. And I think what was funny to me was contrasting it with what came to mind immediately was the scene from Far From Home, where at the very end Peter goes web slinging with MJ and she just screams like, the entire time. That is realistic. That is what that would feel like.
I was thinking that. I was like, because he's got his arm around her somehow, and like not even her hips.
I don't understand,
like,
physics,
like her shoulder. But it's like, you know, you're just getting dragged around like a sack of potatoes at that point.
Yeah.
Like, unless you've got incredible core strength, which is going to get tired after a while. Like, that's going to hurt, you know?
I mean, maybe a lot of it's just momentum. Maybe they're going super fast.
Then she maybe burn up.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's like, she's like, I should get a sweater. It's going to be cold up there. And he's like, no, you're cool. It's like, really?
No. Yeah. No, he's like, I'm never cold up there. Yeah.
What a jerk.
I don't know.
Superman.
I don't know. Maybe just let her get her sweater, you know?
I wanted to call out a couple of weird scenes that are like the ones, or like a good scene and a like, oh dear scene. The oh dear scene is when he rescues the cat out of the tree, which I love because he rescues the cat out of the tree. But then the girl goes inside and tells her parents and they smack and her.
They smack her.
And you're like, oh man, 70s. No.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's meant to be a laugh line, but it's like, that's not funny anymore.
And the one I like, which is, I like the Air Force One getting struck by lightning, which also happens at the beginning. Is it Air Force One in Superman Returns? It's a plane.
It happens. No, somehow it happens right after he saved.
Really?
No. Yeah. They were on Air Force One. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, I enjoy. First of all, there's so many guys in that cockpit that whenever of that era I see that many guys in a cockpit, I just assume I'm watching Airplane. But I love...
No, there's four guys. There's the... Oh, at least three.
I think there's
the,
like, five.
Pilot, co-pilot.
I think there are five.
There are too many.
Really?
Yeah, I think there are like...
There's a lot of guys in a small cockpit.
So when I flew from England to Canada, it was on my 7th birthday, and they invited me into the cockpit, and there was four guys in there. There was the co-pilot, the pilot, obviously, the navigator, and I don't know, somebody else.
There's a flight engineer, probably.
Probably flight engineer.
At that point.
Yeah. And this would have been 1980.
It was the guy holding the cigarettes.
Yeah. But what I like about that scene...
Do you know what? Probably. That wouldn't even have registered with me because there was definitely smoking on that flight.
I just want to say, I really enjoyed the delivery from the pilot at that point when he tells the other guy, like, fly. Don't look.
Yeah.
Just fly.
Yeah.
That sounds like a dubbed line. I've always thought that was dubbed, but I have no evidence of that.
I enjoyed immensely.
Yeah.
Anyways. But that also, you know what? That definitely feels like out of Airplane, right? Like,
yes. But it feels whimsical. And I like that element of it, right? Like, it's don't worry about it. Sure. Something awesome. Let's just land.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah.
And that is, again, I think that's one of the other interesting things looking at movies in the late 70s, because you have, again, I think there is some sort of tension between the realistic and the envelope pushing. Because this scene, you know, a couple minutes later, we have the interview scene with Lois where it gets a little bit edgy, right? Like, we talked about the underwear thing. You know, she asks a bunch of questions, including how big are you, right? Like, there's all this stuff that is like a double entendre, you know, sexual tension type thing, right? And so it is kind of walking the boundary between the modern sensibilities in that day where you were like pushing the envelope a little bit and doing, you know, stuff that's, it's not quite risque, but like, it's a little on the edge for a family-friendly movie, versus stuff that feels more whimsical, more fairy tale-ish. And I think that's what makes this movie really interesting in the era in which it is like, it's not quite sure. Like, it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It's, I don't know if those templates had been written yet, right? Like the,
I don't think it's a template. I think it's a, it's just an aesthetic of the era. Like, I think it's just a reflection of where the, like, we couldn't quite decide. Like, we didn't really know what that looked like at that point. Right. And like,
right. Yeah. I think that's, I think that's why, like, a lot of the films of that era touch on a they have a wider net. They cast a wider net than often we see today. Not that there's not great movies today, but it feels like 70s movies were trying broader and more narrow reaches. Like the focus that they had was not so constrained by sort of what had come before them. I feel like it was an era of cinema that was open to exploring new things, and maybe they worked, maybe they didn't, but nobody was quite sure about which was which.
But there's a bifurcation there too, right? Where it's like, I think prior to that point, it's very clear what a kid's movie is and what an adult movie is.
Right, but that's right.
And then it starts to blur, I think, and when you get to the blockbusters and you realize we want to draw in as many people as possible, right? We want stuff for the kids, we want stuff for the adults. Right. And it's trying to find its footing with that, right? Like, it's not like you watch something like Toy Story today, right? And like that movie that maybe you take your kids to, but there's still a lot of jokes in there that are over the head of the kid audience, and you know, there is a balance. They've established that balance, but in a different way. Whereas I feel like this is still feeling that out a little bit and trying to figure out, like, well, how do we like keep the adults interested and entertain the small kids without, you know, verging into the stuff that is definitely like adult territory.
Right. So I think you could take just rewinding back to the beginning of this conversation. Jaws, a teenage horror movie mixed with the sensibilities of basically amazing filmmaking, right? Mm-hmm. Star Wars, a serial, that I'm trying to avoid sort of food terminology here, but like cooking, but like deconstructed and recreate, like elevated basically into a movie that's like, hey, what if we did that but like really good?
Instead of making a crappy serial, same, we made a good one.
Right, same thing with Jaws. It's like, okay, what if we did like a, you know, here's a monster of the week, like a big ass giant shark. That's scary. Let's do that, but really good. Hey, here's a 30 serial story. Let's do that, but really, really good. Like, let's elevate that. Superman. Let's take a goofy TV show that is about, you know, something that at least by the 70s, by this time in the 70s, had the myth had begun to deflate from the 1950s era all-American style superhero that Superman embodied, right? But it was like, hey, let's take that and treat it seriously. And that's a fascinating sort of moment in culture and a movement in cinema. And I think that a lot of those succeeded. And that's sort of where we find ourselves now, where we can, hey, look, Iron Man's a great movie. Or somehow Avengers Endgame is really moving. I don't know why. I'm not really sure. I liked it. It's great. But you know what? You could do Black Panther. Which is like, that is a seriously fundamentally moving movie to many, 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 many people. And it cloaks itself in this language of a common culture that we share.
Yeah.
And I think that is forged in these movies by taking silly what had previously been silly subject matter and elevating them to, let's actually take that seriously and see what stories we can tell with that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think that's a good way of putting it. All right, let's, moving on from there, I think we have that, we discussed a bunch of the scene with Lois. I think there's an issue. We sort of touching upon this idea of Clark Kent as a character before, and you also mentioned that shot right where Superman leaves and Clark is at the door, and I think it's a great technical shot and it's a great character moment as we see Clark about to, you know, consider revealing himself. I also do question, as I think about it more from a distance, like why he even showed up there. Like, why is he doing this weird fiction of being on a date with her twice in the same night? It's kind of creepy, to use John's description from earlier.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of setting himself up like, I'm trying to trick you, right? Or I have some weird like psychological issues I need to get out of my way as to having this dual personality.
Playing weird mind games with you.
Yeah. But I do love the moment in which he considers coming clean about his identity. And it's especially telling because the other thing that he makes a big point of when he says to Lois in the interview is that he doesn't lie, which of course he does.
Right, all the time.
Well, wait. Here's the thing. Clark lies. Does Superman lie?
He certainly omits the truth.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah, that's... I found myself struggling with that same line.
That moment when he puts the glasses back on, when he changes his mind, is well informed by this scene that I didn't remember, in which, because one of the things that Jor-El tells him is that you need a secret identity because while you're invincible, the people that you love are not invincible. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I feel like when I watched, like I said, I didn't think that I had seen that scene before, and when I watched that movie before, I more thought that it was like, oh no, he's chickening out, or it's a different moment. And in watching it this time, it's more like, no, he's worried about her.
Yeah, that
he's
makes more
concerned,
sense,
you know, because he's afraid that she's gonna get killed by somebody, which you know happens.
I think that's actually a really great point, and I can't remember if that scene was in this and I was just like taking a note or something and missed it, or it wasn't in the version I watched, but I feel like you're right, that does, it does put a much finer point on that, which is... Yeah.
And I think before, when I was talking about it, I thought that it came after that, but I remember distinctly that it came before that, because I mentally made a note of it because of that change in my mind of how that played out.
We get a little more with Lex Luthor and his diabolical plan, as well as his amazing theory quickly proved out that he can kill Superman with kryptonite. Which he figures out in about 20 minutes, apparently. There's another unfortunate line in here of the era where Miss Tessmacher asks something and says, I know I'm going to get wrapped in the mouth for this. And you're like, oh boy.
Yeah.
That whole relationship has some problems.
No, there's, like, yeah, there's, that's not good.
That first scene where they're in it, and I wrote in my notes, like, what is she wearing? Like,
oh, that first scene.
Yeah, she's wearing like a nightgown, basically. Like, she looks like a Bond girl.
Well, it's tight, yeah. I mean, but it's like tights and... Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Anyways.
I was watching with my friend. She was like, well, man, I love that outfit. Yeah. I'm like... Yeah, me too. Can't argue with that. So, yeah.
It's... I mean, it's nice that, you know, at least for the era, it's... And I guess she was... But she was always a reporter. At least Lois is like a professional.
Woman. No. Yeah.
But like
most
of the women in this movie don't come off all well, you know, like aren't treated all that well.
No. Tessmacher is clearly a damaged individual. I don't think you could come away with this movie to think.
Right.
I mean, she literally abuses Superman when he is incapable of making a choice.
Right.
She's clearly not an avatar of or some kind of sexual paragon. Like she's as corrupt as any of the rest of them in
possibly
a way. She's made a little bit of a victim,
but she does it. She basically does it to save her mother.
Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know? She doesn't do it. She doesn't do it because it's the right thing to do. She said, does it to save her mother.
Right.
At least she loves her mother, I guess.
Right, yeah. Like, there's limits to Tess Bonker's sort of, I guess, humanity kind of thing. Yeah. And she does want to kiss him, which I guess we're made to think is cute, but is ultimately kind of like...
uncomfortable.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, right. Well, so you gave Superman a roofie.
Kryptonite roofie.
Cool. Like, I don't know.
Right. Well, we have the same... Yeah. Not
you're,
long...
you're lucky he's not a vindictive asshole, because that would not have gone well for you.
Yeah. We also have the bit that's not far off here where we essentially have her act as the decoy for the stopping the missile character. Missile carrier.
Oh yeah.
Which is another horrible scene.
Yeah. Very unfortunate scene where it's played.
With Larry Hagman.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? If you're gonna have anybody be date rapey, Larry Hagman's the guy. To the estate of Larry Hagman, I don't mean that. But Jerry Ewing, that fits, right? Like, that's not
Major Nelson kept the woman imprisoned for
I was where I was thinking.
How many seasons of that show? I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
All of them. So we have the whole, this is sort of where the actual plot comes into play, where Otis is sent to change the coordinates, fails, and then Miss Tessmacher is sent to change the coordinates on the missiles. Lex immediately has a backup plan when the first plan goes awry. And just has a different wig and somehow talks to the same soldiers and nobody notices.
Yeah, I think they're fine. No, but they're different missiles.
Oh, those are the two missiles. You're right.
There's an army missile and a navy missile.
The accidental one goes to kill. Oh, that's when it goes to Hackensack.
Mother. Yeah. Yes. Right.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, I couldn't remember how that worked.
That makes
out
a lot more sense. We also have everybody like transplanted to the West Coast for this last act. Except for Clark. Lois is...
This makes no sense, by the way. Oh, by the way, they are on assignment out west to photograph the dam?
Well, Lois is interviewing...
Oh, because people are buying... Lex is buying up all that land.
Real estate.
She's investigating the...
Right. So, but I love that she's doing...
Yeah, but that's a bit of a plot convenience playhouse going on. Oh, sure. Right? But,
I love that she's doing a podcast interview while driving.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I love what that guy says. Yeah. By the way, she's like interviewing
Native American.
Native American. Okay, yeah. And he's like, I don't know. They gave us money. They gave us so much money for this super useless piece of land. So I hope it's Custer.
Yeah,
which it's like,
right? Because I'm robbing him.
Yeah, she's like, how could you give up this land? And if you've followed any Native American, like, that's not their land. That they got moved and they got stuck with a bunch
with
of
the crappy with the crappy land. That's why
with
yeah,
the really really you, crappy land, right? So if somebody wants to come along,
it's gonna be beachfront property soon,
right? So if somebody wants to come along and just give them like amazing amounts of money, and they're like, yeah, whatever, I will take their money for this garbage land that we got given, and I hope it's Custer, because double fingers to the lot of you, like, just all of you. Yeah. And yeah, little does he know, poor guy, that yeah, he's still getting screwed by the white man. So that stinks. Well, I mean, and to be fair, so is California. That's... Is that possible if you drop a nuke on the fault?
It's okay. Not. It's not how any of this works. Let's be clear. Back in Metropolis, Lex broadcasts on the Superman channel, which is the channel that the dogs can hear.
The dog channel.
And threatens the city. That's our fade is where he fades into the costume when he jumps out the window situation. We also do get a I think delightful scene where he does the spinning drilling down underground thing, which I really enjoy. And I just want to touch on Gene Hackman here, who we haven't talked about, but I absolutely love his delivery after Superman breaks down the door, the way he says, "It's open, come in," you know, like it's the delivery is so good. And then when he tells
Hackman is great in everything.
Yeah, Hackman. I mean, and I was just looking because I know he has actively retired, and I was like, God, can you believe he hasn't been in a movie for 15 years? I miss him so much.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that like a few years ago too.
Yeah, he's one of those guys who like he literally retired, if not at the top of his game, like he went out on his own terms, and I love that. Like,
what was his last that submarine movie?
No, his last movie was Welcome to Moosewood, which is I don't know if it's particularly good, but it's he plays in a former U.S. president. I think Ray Romano's in it too. But. You know,
he should have gone out on a submarine movie.
I think one of his last ones, though, is Royal Tenenbaums, which is a solid movie. He did three after that, including a Grisham one, I think, with Dustin Hoffman, which he wanted to do because Dustin Hoffman and he were old friends. My wife is informing me that Welcome to Moosewood is a good Mooseport is a good movie, so. I'll take her word for it. I've never seen it.
All right. Yeah. I had not heard of it.
But Hackman, that line and the line where he tells Otis to take the gentleman's cape, I think are the this is
take the gentleman's cape is one of my favorite things. And then,
yeah. And then his glare.
It's like Ned Beatty is like, I don't think he wants me to take his cape.
And that whole scene with Christopher Reeve and Gene Hackman is fascinating because it is both cut from the mold of your classic superhero confronting your villain, but also kind of undercut with Gene Hackman. Lex's whole plan is like, get Superman to open this box, right? And so he's like totally confident with the like, I'm just going to tell you everything. And Superman, because he is above all in some ways, Superman is like a superhero of etiquette and politeness. He takes the time to listen to him, including my favorite bit where he's like, do you know about the San Andreas Fault? And Superman's like, yes, let me tell you about the San Andreas Fault. I'm like, why are you having this conversation with him?
Just punch him.
It's very funny.
It's great.
But I love their rapport there, I think it's fascinating. I just think it's really funny and it's kind of delightful, even if it's somewhat strange at the same time.
Well, again, it's two great actors playing against each other. Like Reeves is playing like a goofball, and Hackman is playing goofy, evil genius. He's definitely the straight man in that scene. 100%, and he knows it, and he's playing it, and he kills it. It's so perfect. Yeah, and that's why like it feels diabolical when he manages to wrap him up in kryptonite. It's like, oh god, I believe that because he was a straight man the whole time, and he thought this joke was going to be on him.
Yeah,
but he's like they laid out those breadcrumbs three scenes before.
Right. Yeah.
And now Superman's drowning in a stupid pool with kryptonite all over him. It is a very cool pool. Yeah. If I was going to die from kryptonite poisoning inside a pool, it would probably be that one. Yeah.
So, yes, we have, again, Lex's whole plot being let's get him to open this box and be exposed to kryptonite. And so he explains everything he's going to do with the nuking the fault line and all of that. And then we have our classic, you know, I will always remember this speech because, so I don't know if you guys are familiar with, there's a YouTube series long running called How It Should Have Ended, which has like its little animated versions of how this movie should have ended. And the Superman one is by far my favorite. And I will always remember it because it has this little monologue where he talks about the like double jeopardy Superman. Even you with your great speed couldn't possibly stop both missiles at once. And in the How It Should Have Ended video, it involves Superman going, I'm sorry, what did you say? He's like, I said, even you with your great speed. Oh, that's what I thought you said. And then he like flies out and then comes back and he's just holding both missiles. And he's just like, I flew around the Earth twice and these are the only missiles I can find. Are these the ones you were talking about? And I really enjoy that. It's a very funny video. But yes, it's all lead into Superman opening the lead box and getting whammied with kryptonite, which is... You know, it's a Superman movie. It's got to happen, right?
Yeah.
So the funny thing about that is that somehow, out of the blue, Luther just deduces that this meteorite...
Well, yeah, that's a whole...
Yeah. All right. Okay, cool.
That has never made any sense to me whatsoever.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
The rock
I want to
from
say
his
it.
Own planet will kill him. What?
Why?
Why?
Rocks
Who
from
knows?
Our planet kill us. I mean, if you throw him hard enough...
Right. It doesn't matter. fine. And the thing that bugged me this time was it wasn't just like he figured it out. It was like he was like, how do you idiots not see this? Like, well, because you're kind of making a leap here, Luther. Like,
yeah,
you may like that's a decent hypothesis. Okay, fine. Radiation, maybe. Don't treat these people like they're idiots because they didn't go to, like, come on.
I like that Superman really tries for a good long time to break the chain around his neck when you're like, dude, just take it off.
Take it off. Right.
Take
he tries
it off.
That for a second and that doesn't, you can't even do that, but then he still tries to break it. It's like, if you can't lift it over your head, you're not going to be able to break it.
Probably just maneuver your head through it because it's sinking, right? Like, you should float. And
just do a headstand and then
you're in water. Just up. Like, yeah, spin around. I don't know. I will say that with the wet hair at the end when he takes off, there's a shot of him in profile, and I thought to myself, man, does he look like Brandon Routh in that shot.
Like, oh, yeah.
Was some great casting.
Yeah. Brandon Routh is a great Superman.
He is a great Superman.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If we had more dumb times, maybe we should watch Returns.
I only saw it once in the theater, and I would rewatch
We'd have to watch Superman 2 first.
That's fair. That's fair.
Superman 2 is probably one of my favorite movies.
It's pretty
child.
I've only seen that one once as well, but I remember
liking
it.
There's a lot to like about it.
It's really, really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll discuss that. I was going to say, I had somewhere else in my notes just pointing out that it is a damn shame that we lost Christopher Reeve so young. I mean, even... Mm-hmm. After his accident and stuff like that, but like, you know, he died, he was only 52 or something. Like, he should, by all rights, he should still be around. And he is so good in this, and it's a shame that we didn't get more time with him, because
Christopher Reeve just made the world better. Like, that this Christopher Reeve to me was what a superhero was on screen. Superman was impeccable. If you haven't appreciated the next movie, especially, he really goes through a superhero journey on that.
He's given a lot more to do in the next one.
Yes, right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I think that is interesting how little time we get with Superman in this movie, especially from like scenes where he actually gets dialogue. Right, like so much he's in the whole last act, but sort of after he and Miss Tessmacher have, you know, their coming to an agreement moment. Most of it's just flying around and saving people, right? Like, he doesn't get a lot of dialogue.
No, it's the action-packed finale. But, importantly, he saves everybody he can.
Saves the bus.
He saves
Jimmy.
First of all, he's true to his word, right? Is that he saves Tessmacher's family first.
Of course.
Because he's Superman.
Does that come up? Because that was not specifically, I felt like that wasn't in the, like, we just assume he does it, or is that actually explicit?
He pushes the first missile out into space.
All right.
And here's the thing, that missile that goes into space is supposed to blow the up the Phantom Zone.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the Hackensack one frees Zod is basically the, it's not explicit, but that's always the way I took it. Is that true, John?
The Hackensack one is what?
He shoots it into space, and I thought that was one that blew up and broke the Phantom Zone.
You're right. I was thinking, now that you said that, because when I was watching this movie, I was thinking, oh, and they get put in the Phantom Zone, and then the explosion of Krypton ruptures their thing. But I think it is the nuclear bomb, but I can't remember now.
I guess we'll have to watch that one.
Which is, I'm not afraid of doing it at all because it's great.
But
then, after having saved Hackensack to be true to his word, he flies out west and lifts up the San Andreas Fault, saves a bunch of people, picks up the school bus, does a bunch of stuff on the bridge, is generally awesome. But when he's all feeling satisfied with himself, somehow way off in the distance, he forgot about his girlfriend. Yeah. And she is getting crushed by Boulders and rocks and sand.
I have a long list of, I don't think this is how rockets don't fly this low. I don't think that's how you cause earthquakes. I don't think that's how earthquakes work.
No, yes.
That's some problems. An evil earth monster eating Lois. That's not an earthquake.
Yeah, right.
So Dan, where were you in 1978?
You know what? No one asked me these things. I was available as a consultant at the ripe age of -2.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we don't want to hear from you. On this portion.
Guy's pulling a, he's pretending it's like one of the episodes where you're not here.
No. I'm just joking. But yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense. But if you watched it at the time when we were younger, well, I mean, John's way, way older than me. I mean, it's a miracle that guy's alive.
I was in graduate school when I saw this movie.
Thank God for modern science. Yeah. But basically, it didn't matter. It didn't matter the arc of missiles. It didn't matter that they were flying the nape of the Earth somehow, for some reason. It looked cooler, and that was fine. Most importantly, Superman or Clark gets into the situation again where he cannot save the person that he loves. Right.
Yeah, which I think is like, you know, as a kid, I don't really think that I picked up on the parallel. You know, like, I don't think I understood that, oh, this is like, you know, hearkening back to when his dad died, and like, this is, he's going to make a different decision at this point. It's like, that's not, you know, something that occurs to a young kid. Not that I was super young.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting.
Not that I was super young feels like your motto. Like, that should probably be your next t-shirt.
Not that I was super young.
Well, I do want to say this is that teeter-totter moment, which I talked about very early on in our conversation, because in our traditional superhero movie at this point, Superman flies around and saves everybody, and he should, by all rights, just save Lois, and that's a happy ending, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Right.
And so you have that moment of both a filmmaker, I think, needing to realize, like, we need to kill a character, essentially, even if temporarily, mm-hmm. To actually impose stakes of some variety. Right. And I think it's an interesting choice. It's something that I think definitely sets it apart from the superhero stories that came before it, right? Like, that was never going to happen in the Adam West Batman series. No. Did they kill anybody, really? Except for those people they turned to sand in the Batman movie. The UN people? Even them, most of them get, like, brought back, I think, at the end. But, like, you want this, it's almost a fairy tale-ish thing, and not like a classic, you know, original Grimm's fairy tale, but the versions that we tell kids where everything works out in the end and everybody is saved. And that does happen eventually, but we throw up that roadblock and we have that scene. And I think that's significant because it does give me, like, I think it opens the door to the grittier, darker superhero stuff that we start getting in the 80s through today. You could probably trace that, I think, all the way to the terrible Man of Steel movie and people feeling like, hey, yeah, Superman can be dark. And I think it was interesting and innovative of the era, but I actually wonder about the legacy of that and whether it's done more harm than good.
I don't know, John, I don't hang that on this.
Yeah, I wouldn't either, but I mean, he doesn't hurt anybody by doing this, really.
No, he breaks
one of his own rules, but he does it to save people, and he at that point decides how he's going to be Superman, not how his, you know, Jor-El wants him to be Superman.
Right. Fair. He does not go on a mission of vengeance.
True.
Yeah.
Yes, I
watched this movie and thought about Man of Steel, and this comes up in Man of Steel, at least in part of it, is, you know, how he's supposed to be a symbol and how he's supposed to inspire the human race, because he, you know, he is apart from them, but so he cannot really be one of them, and he has to stand above and be something to strive for. And then, you know, in the end of Man of Steel, oh no, he's gonna kill somebody, he's gonna get down on the floor and kill somebody, literally. And in this movie, he does let his emotions get the best of him in a way, and get a, you know, pull him away from what he thought was his set of rules, but it's all internal. It's, he's the only one who knows what happened.
Right.
So he doesn't damage his, to the human race, he still looks like he's this incredible thing who is flawless.
Well, and there is a challenge inherent in this too, because I think the challenge for me is that in some ways the ending feels like a cheat. Because, and some, well, of this, yeah, is the way that it's constructed.
Because time travel is a cheat.
Well, I agree with you 100%, but even more so here, where time travel doesn't feel like it obeys any of the actual rules of time travel.
Yeah, one of my notes was, where's the other Superman?
Right, well, not only that,
well, the
but others, like,
yeah, yeah.
The, not only that, like, all the others, everything else is the same, right? Like, everything else, except for Lois's car doesn't fall into the ditch, right? Like, the, and I'm just kind of trying to figure, like, but if you rewound far enough, what changed other than you going, yeah, back in time? Because he doesn't show up and save her. He shows up and nothing has happened to her.
Right.
No, he right. shows up before anything's happened to her.
No, but then the ground doesn't split open. Like, in all likely, like, he's already averted, yeah, the rest of the disaster.
She doesn't get, yeah, that's right. That's a good question.
It doesn't, I mean, actually make sense when you think about it.
Did he stop the bomb? I guess he stopped the bomb.
But there's
my take.
She remembers.
Yeah, that's right. Because it did go off. Because there's other stuff. Yeah, that's a good. That's a good point. I don't know.
My take is that he goes back in time for that. There's two of them in operation.
I guess so.
One of them fixing stuff.
Maybe he pushes the fault back together faster. Who knows?
Yeah. Again, this is why I find it a little unsatisfying. Because going back in time and saving things, you know, that's a Barry Allen specialty. Like, fine. I'm
okay. I thought his specialty was going back in time and screwing things
that's
up.
That's a fair point. There's usually consequences, right? I guess it rung a little hollow to me just because it felt like there ought to be consequences.
Dan, I gotta say that I feel that you coming at this 30 years later is 30 years worth of time travel mechanics baked in, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that this really occurred to anybody at the time. I don't.
It's not going to stop me.
I don't.
From coming
I,
for
I
it.
Just. I honestly don't think that anybody cared to think about how you would dissect this. 40 years yeah. later.
Well, I mean,
and I,
they
no,
also...
I don't mean that. I, like, so obviously, I'm sounding dismissive and I'm joking, but I don't think it mattered at the time.
No,
I think
I,
it was
not.
About the feeling. Again. I think it was about him screaming, doing something extreme, and then being able to save his love. And I think that's what it was about, not the particulars of the mechanics of
You're
it.
You're absolutely right, because this is also 40 years ago when apparently they thought time travel could be achieved by flying around the world and reversing its direction. So, you know,
no,
whatever.
Oh, that's a bad effect.
I think I thought we had decided it's that fine. He's not reversing the direction. He's just flying backwards in time, and the Earth is spinning backwards because
it's fine. I'm willing. I think
that's the modern interpretation of that. Although, you know, I think when I saw it when I was a kid,
right.
It was, oh, he's flying backwards so fast, he's making the Earth turn around and go backwards, and
right.
Everyone's yeah.
But
everyone
here's
flies
the thing
off.
With the modern interpretation, which I caught last night, is that he flies backwards, the Earth starts rotating the wrong way. And then somehow he changes direction and starts rotating the right way again. Like, did he overshoot the time? And
yeah,
then
really,
come
I
back?
Know. Like, what was the point
like,
of that?
Right? It's right.
I guess just like, to get it spinning again.
I mean, he only goes back in time like 20 yeah. minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway,
who knows?
Sorry. Take shots at the movie, but I'm gonna again. I don't have as much nostalgia for it.
Just with regards to the time travel thing, early on in the movie, when he took Lois for a flight, she asked him, "Have you ever clocked yourself and how fast you can fly?" And he said, "No."
Yes,
and I think that was a bit of a setup to be like, you know what, I can fly faster than light, and when I get really mad and yell at the sky, I am gonna go fix it, which is. Definitely It's a fridge moment.
It's also
Lois got fridged. Yes. On the other hand, she didn't get fridged in order to make him incite him to go on a killing spree. I don't know how to deal with that. I still think it's a fridging, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I like that Superman doesn't take the opportunity to go and burn Lex Luthor's head off with his laser beam eyes.
Never seen.
Which, by the way, happens in The Boys. So,
But also never. I noticed that there are a lot of powers that don't show up. Like he doesn't use. I always find the Superman power thing interesting because so much of it was. There was the like times in like the 30s and 40s in the Golden Age where like they just make up new powers for him every week.
Right.
Oh yeah. Right.
But yeah, I was gonna say I think you're right. I think it's also interesting because we have that Jor-El thing set up earlier where he's like, you cannot appear in the history of human events or something, which is a weird thing to say.
Right. Right. Because he goes around, you know, affecting
right.
the outcome of things all the time.
Yes. But it clearly he just meant
yeah I kind of feel that Jor-El's just like I think Jor-El's position there is you just go live life as a human who won't get mugged,
just be a really you know? Good human,
like you'll like, be okay,
but he's you supposed know, to fine. But at the same time he expects him to be an
Paragon.
Ideal.
Yeah,
I guess so. Yeah, I don't know how you do those.
Dads
things.
Give conflicting yeah. messages sometimes, as always.
Exactly. Tell me about it. Speaking of which, I need to go up the stairs and give some conflicting messages.
Right.
All right. Well, we have reached the end of this movie. I hope all you out
Two
there
hours.
Enjoyed listening along with us. We hope you got a chance to watch the movie, maybe, and revisit it if you haven't seen it in a while or see it for the first time.
Yeah. And figure out which version you're watching.
Yeah, that's most important. I don't know what we're doing. I know we there were technically some superhero sweep stuff I think we only have one letter, but I think we're gonna have to
let's save it.
I think we'll have to kick those to next week.
It's from a long suffering fan, the only one.
Yeah,
Sam Cook.
Sorry, Sam. We're gonna have to kick the letter to next week. Yeah. We've gone on long enough.
2 hours is a little bit much.
Yeah.
Yes. So thank you all for tuning in. We will be back next week. I'm not sure what we'll talk about, but we'll come up with something. If you got suggestions, feel free to send them in. We may or may not do them, but we'll certainly take a look.
Probably ignore them.
Yeah, that's kind of
who we find
it
amusing.
What a funny suggestion.
To make you jump through ridiculous hoops.
We're jerks. We're all jerks here. Anyways, yes, thank you again for listening. Thank you for all your support, especially to our members at The Incomparable. And I'd like, of course, to thank the rest of my super team. John Maltz, thanks for being here.
Dan, you may not take my cape.
Guy English, always a pleasure.
It's been a blast, really. If you ever find me drowning in a pool with kryptonite on me, just take the kryptonite off first. I promise you, I'll give you a kiss. Just
no
get
problem.
It off me. Just get it off me first, please. Thank you.
And thank you to all of our readers out there. We will see you next week.
Oh
man, I forgot to mention how much I love John Williams' score. It's so good.
Yeah, I'm shocked by that. That is like,
on my notes.
That's up there with Star Wars. It really is.
It's a really great theme.